rightly pointed out. But in DMATA, even in DMATA, what they talk about there is really based on an instruction, is what that case is based on, whether or not the proper instruction was given. The inconsistent statement, I think, was pretty clear about it was a denial. So really, DMATA, with regards to how the appellant poses it, that it's denials, equivocations, silence, those kinds of things, really is dicta.
Well, counsel, do you disagree with the statement in DMATA, or are you just saying that it's dicta and we shouldn't pay any attention to it?
Well, I guess there's the government suggests that this court look at DMATA certainly for the purposes of the standard of review in this case. That is, that the judge enjoys a wide discretion and wide latitude to decide first were the statements inconsistent, and then how to use those statements or admit those statements.
Well, and the language that we're talking about in DMATA tells us what a inconsistent statement is. So my question is, do you disagree with that, that it can be inconsistent if it's evasive, if it, they have an inability to recall, silence, or change of positions? Is that wrong?
Well, I think it depends, because what I think DMATA also points out is that what you're looking at is really the totality of the circumstances under, whether it's the direct and cross-examination, his testimony, what was the broad view of what was going on there?
So in certain circumstances, these four bases would constitute an inconsistent statement.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
And in this case, why don't these two statements, when you said, I don't recall, why doesn't that trigger the DMATA rule?
Well, because I think that it's more on the line of Grubbs, in which case you're looking at the value of all the testimony. And when he's testifying about, I don't recall, I don't remember, the intent of what I don't recall or I don't remember is important, because if it's looked at as being evasive for the purposes of trying to hide behind I don't remember so he doesn't have to admit he told a lie, that's one thing. And that's when I think that the DMATA kicks in. If you have a situation where it looks like the individual is saying I don't remember for purposes of being evasive and not admitting what's going on, that's one thing. But someone who just honestly can't recall.
So you're combining there, you're adding to the DMATA rule that not only would it be a inability to recall, but it has to be an evasive inability to recall.
The government's suggesting that's the policy behind why sometimes silence and inability to recall can be impeached extrinsically, because that's important. What is the substance of why he's doing that?
Counsel, was the issue of whether the baby was crying before or after the departure from the house?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the issue of whether the baby was crying before or after a significant issue in this case?
Well, it was a, I don't know about significant, it was certainly an issue.
It was an issue in the case. And did the witness give two different versions of whether the baby was crying? One version at trial, the baby was crying before. One version in a pretrial statement, the baby was crying after.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. And the members only heard one version coming into evidence, the baby was crying before.
Well, the government suggests that they didn't. I mean, while it didn't come in extrinsically, for example, the investigator coming in and testifying as to the statement, for all intents and purposes, it did come in, because during the cross-examination, counsel certainly was going into that. Didn't you
say? It did come in as evidence, was Judge Efron's question.
Well, it certainly came in for purposes of I think the members looking at the demeanor and deciding about the credibility, whether or not it came in as definitive evidence.
Right. No. And wouldn't the judge have instructed, and I believe he did, but I have to check again, instruct the members that counsel's questions and arguments do not constitute evidence in the case?
That's correct.
And even if the statement had come in, it wouldn't have come in for anything but credibility anyhow, would it?
That's correct.
The OSI agent's statement.
That's correct.
It couldn't have come in for the truth of the matter asserted.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
It would have come in to dispute the truth of the matter asserted on direct examination, though. That is, the members could have taken that into account to determine that the witness was not telling the truth, that the baby was only crying before.
Impeaching, the classic impeaching for credibility.
And so in that sense, why is it important whether the absence of the information is a result of the witness's purpose, whether it's a purpose of evasion when the witness says, I don't remember, or whether it's a true lack of memory? After all, the witness is not on trial here. The defendant's on trial, and this is a purpose of the trial to determine the truth of what happened. Why should if the witness admits that the statement is inconsistent, then the extrinsic evidence doesn't come in because there's no disagreement about the inconsistency. The members have that before them. If the witness denies the inconsistency, then the statement comes in so the members can evaluate it. If the witness says, I don't remember, why aren't the members of the court-martial panel, the jury, in the same position as they would be if the person denied the statement? That is, they don't know. They don't have the benefit unless the extrinsic evidence comes in and they can weigh it.
Well, because I think the policy behind the rule with regards to ferreting out lies and the truth for cross-examination purposes runs counter to allowing someone to say someone's a liar for purposes of putting on the extrinsic testimony or document or whatever it is you're using to impeach, as opposed to someone who's, that might be true, I just don't remember right now. There's a big difference. So I think that the law distinguishes that. And I think in the cases of D'Amato and those other Grubbs, they talk about Wigmore and the policy behind that. It's that. Ferreting out the truth and the lie. If he admits, yeah, I said that, well, clearly he lied.
But counsel, wouldn't that allow a witness then to merely say, I don't recall, and allow him not to be confronted with a prior inconsistent statement? All he'd have to do is say, I don't remember that.
Well, here's where some trial strategy comes into play, because I think it's defense counsel's obligation at that point to then do whatever he needs to do, whether it's refreshing recollection. You're not necessarily just stuck with the answer and then move on when he says, I don't remember. You can go through the scenario that I think was done a few times in this case. Didn't you write this statement? Please read, does that refresh your recollection? And if you say, no, that doesn't refresh my recollection, then we're getting into, is he saying no, I don't remember, like in Grubbs,
I mean, this appeared to me to be a new argument that the government has. If the defense counsel would have made an attempt to refresh the witness's recollection, it would cast a different light on the case that we're looking at?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to do is explain that, to Your Honor's question, that once you say, didn't you say at this statement X, and he says, I don't remember, that you're not just necessarily stuck with that. Because I think the impression of the jury at that point, when you're refreshing recollection and they continue to deny, and it's clear what's going on, that the members are getting the point.
So is that an argument to just jump to closing arguments and just have the lawyers present their arguments? I mean, in the law, is there a difference between evidence and argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We admit that, but I think that during the cross examination, obviously the members are taking into account the demeanor that obviously comes into play too.
And is it true that in this particular case, didn't the defense counsel use all the devices that you're talking about by showing him his prior, showing him the prior statements and asking him if he recalled making them?
Yes, Your Honor. For most of them.
Why?
And what did the CCA find? Did they find the statements inconsistent?
Well, it's a little unclear. I think that they, when looking at the standard, the Air Force Court determined maybe a reasonable person could see that maybe this was an inconsistent for purposes of the rule to allow extrinsic evidence, but in light of the wide discretion allowed the judge.
But you're arguing here that you disagree with the CCA. You don't view these as inconsistent?
Well, I'm suggesting, and I understand that brings up the law of the case doctrine, and I expect that question from Judge Efron. But
one of the advantages of oral argument in a case like this is counsel can ask and answer their own questions. Please proceed.
However, we suggest, for purpose of the law of the case doctrine, that it doesn't apply in this case because certainly appellant has rehashed that issue in their brief. They didn't simply just agree with the Air Force Court and move on to a different issue. So we feel compelled.
I'm sorry. In terms of law in the case, I mean, the law of the case is that they said we could find it this way, but we're going to use the standard of review, and so it wasn't inconsistent.
Right. Well,
but we're not going to say it was inconsistent.
Well, that was going to be my next point. I was just doing a tier argument, but I think they threw out, we find that someone could, this would be reasonable, someone could, reasonable minds could say this is an inconsistent statement for purpose of 613B.
It would have been reasonable to determine his testimony at trial was inconsistent with his prior statement.
I'm sorry, say that again, Jim.
I'll just read it to you so you can refresh. It would have been reasonable to determine his testimony at trial was inconsistent with his prior statement. That's what the CCA states.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I think, though, that really brings out the point of the standard here. Maybe I think that it's not reasonable. The Court of Criminal Appeals may think it's reasonable, but differing minds may differ, and that's certainly well below the standards of abuse of discretion.
And my question originally was not about the law of the case, but which position the government is presenting today and in its brief.
We're suggesting
that you're arguing abuse of discretion, or you're arguing that it wasn't inconsistent to begin with.
Both. We're arguing that it's
In the alternative. Then, which is your lead argument, please?
The lead argument is that it's not inconsistent, and that in the alternative, that abuse of discretion saves the case.
On issue three, that was admitted for what purpose? The parental, prior instances of parental abuse?
Well, really it was admitted for purposes of intent.
Okay, and the intent being the intent to kill?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the one of those instances was flicking, whatever that
yes,
means.
Yes, Your Honor.
But flicking. How does one distinguish between a parent, different people have different moral views on this and so on, but if you see a mother or father slapped their child in the grocery store, does that demonstrate an intent to kill? So therefore, when I see that happen in the grocery store, I should rush up and seize that parent, indeed to protect the child, since I've seen an intent to kill. Does that not reflect an intent to kill?
Not that one instance, Your Honor.
Okay, how do you distinguish this instance from that instance?
Well, first you have to...
how are we to know?
Well, first you have to accumulate the instances that were ultimately admitted here. And secondly, I think the important point is what was the environment that was going on during these times?
So
it's not simply the action.
I go to the grocery store and I see the same event play out three times or five times or 10 times. Intent to kill?
Well, if I could answer the question this way.
Yeah.
If, for example, you're seeing someone in the grocery store overreact to a particular situation.
And you're not stuck with my hypothetical. You can, I'm trying to get your principles of law here.
Right. If you have someone that's overreacting to a particular situation, for example, the baby is crying and this individual completely and utterly overreacts in arguably maybe a disciplinary capacity, that is going overboard with violence,
assaulting the child. Some people would argue that any physical contact with the child is overboard. Is that the government's argument?
No, not necessarily. I mean, obviously the situation has to have context, and that's why we have the 404, the Reynolds test, to determine whether or not these particular instances are going to be related to the charged conduct. So, for example, in this case, if you have these instances that seem like potentially disciplinary measures, but as the Air Force Court, I think, pointed out, was when you have an individual that's overreacting to a situation and causes and does violence to solve the situation, it goes a long way to show that when in a similar situation you have crying, like in this case, on the day of the event, it goes a long way to showing her intent to kill.
But that sounds a lot like propensity argument.
Right.
That because a individual acted one way on one day is evidence that they acted another way on another day. And what we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about propensity evidence here. What we're talking about is, what do you get from those prior acts that demonstrate an intent to intentionally kill or seriously injure, the intent to kill or seriously injure Destiny? Do any of those incidents reflect that intent? I don't disagree with you if a person overreacts in one area, it may be evidence that they're going to overreact in another area, but the rule doesn't allow that type of evidence.
Sure. But in this situation, where in particular in these kinds of cases that are very difficult, the child abuse and the rape trauma, those kinds of issues that come up, I think the court has given some latitude on in the past. And so
do the defendants have less rights depending on the severity of the crime? Is there a sliding scale?
No, I think that in a situation where you have complex issues that the this court has allowed, for example, experts to testify in an area that would be helpful that might not be helpful in another area, trauma, for example, rape trauma.
Do you agree with the appellant's assertion that in order for this to come in, it has to be at a certain level on a continuum of violence, without necessarily trying to fix where on that continuum it goes?
If I understand your question correctly,
the appellant argued that this wouldn't come in because it was too minor and it therefore didn't bear a sufficient relationship to an intent to inflict grievous bodily harm. Are you saying that it has to be at a certain level? You seem to be saying something approaching that the uncharged misconduct has to be somewhere on a certain continuum of violence to be admissible.
Well, I guess there has to be some, I think the case law is fairly clear that says there has to be some linking. But I don't necessarily agree that there has to be a certain level of violence to meet the conduct of violence. For example, a murder, you have to approach violence that's just short of murder. So I guess I disagree with the continuum in that regard.
I have a question to ask you, counsel. It seems to me from the parts of the record that I've read that the military judge initially admitted the evidence of minor parental abuse, the past instances, to show intent and a pattern of to show intent, and then but that he instructed on lack of accident. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was that a proper or correct thing for the military judge to do? And if so, why?
Well, initially the motions that came in were the prosecution is wanting to admit it for intent in absence of mistake. So, you know, it's hard to reconcile one with the other, but I think it was pretty clear that those were the two reasons, and the judge had in his mind through some of the case law, I think in the motions, that he used that terminology. But in the end, I think when he had time to sit down and think, I mean, write down the instructions, appropriately instruct, that it was those two things, I think, that came out.
Is there, and I asked this question of appellant, and am not really satisfied that I understand, and that's my fault, not yours, but is there a difference between intent to kill and an accident in the context of this case and this evidence?
Well, that is a very difficult question, because I think the two can be interrelated. But I guess where it separates in this case is the fact that she had made statements, admissions about throwing her child up. She called it, but throwing the child up, and that's possibly how it happened. And I think that's what was the part of absence of mistake / accident instruction that was given by the judge that was different than just the intent element of look at the uncharged conduct and relate that to intent. Did I answer your question?
I think as well as it could be answered at the moment.
In the end, what I'd like to say is to the first issue is certainly I'm not conceding the prejudice element in any regard. Whether this court decides to look at harmless error of a constitutional magnitude under the Sixth Amendment, or whether they look at the prejudice, certainly the government suggests there's no prejudice. All that information that they talk about came out in court ultimately. The members had an opportunity to look at it, and he used it in argument. More importantly on that aspect, though, is, let me move, I see I'm running short on time, so let me move on, though, to the uncharged acts again. The harm, we're also not suggesting that there's no harm, this is harmless error.
Do you have anything to offer on which standard is applicable in this case and why on the first issue, assuming error, whether it's constitutional error or whether it's non-constitutional error? What should we bring to bear on that?
The government suggests that it's that in this case that it's not the Sixth Amendment constitutional error as evidenced in Davis v. Alaska and Douglas v. Alabama, that those cases involved whole lines of questioning thrown out. Here, the questioning wasn't thrown out. They were allowed to question. It just didn't go as far as they felt that it should go. So, in that regard, we suggest that this court use the prejudice analysis short of harmless error.
If you could turn to issue 4 just real briefly, can you talk for just a moment about how the statement with respect to the age, how the statement with respect to the fact that it was normally the parent that would be the person that killed a child under the age of 12 months, why the criticism of that particular statement in Banks doesn't decide the issue here?
Well,
with respect to that statement?
It's, yes, Your Honor. The obviously, as the defense pointed out, and I think came up during the initial go-around at the Air Force Court, was the Traum case, that this court addressed that exact statement and suggested that that goes
not that statement. I mean, that statement was criticized in Traum also.
Correct, that Traum. Right, may I understand your question, Your Honor?
Okay, let's just the statement about the biological parent being the source of the injury or death, whether we take it from Banks, whether we take its reaffirmation of it being criticized in Traum, why don't those two cases decide how we rule on that specific statement in this case?
Well, it's the government's contention that.
Is it error, and then you argue prejudice, or are you arguing it's not error to start with?
Well, obviously, the government's strongest argument is harmless, is the harmless error factor. But what the government would like to suggest this court look at is look at this particular situation, and perhaps like they did, like this court did in Banker. Narrow the scope in which this kind of testimony can be allowed, because, as is pointed out in child abuse cases, and where certain symptoms are allowed to be testified to by an expert. Similarly, in this case, the policy behind those is that an expert testifies about. What a particular situation.
I'm sorry, can you be more precise? Are you asking us to overrule and reverse Traum in Banks? Is that what you're asking for here?
We are asking the court here to go back and say, in light of the fact that the policy behind the certain expert testimony in these areas, that this is the kind of evidence that's helpful to the members to determine.
This being the statements about the biological parent being the most likely person to kill the child?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's the government's view that notwithstanding Traum and Banks, that should be an admissible form of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't this a swearing contest between two biological parents?
In essence, Your Honor.
Is this the case to go overrule Traum? When the issue seems to be one of prejudice?
Well, certainly, you know, the government's best argument here is the prejudice argument.
Well, I'm saying assume for the moment. I mean, would this even be an appropriate case to go as far as you want to go?
Well, certainly in light of who knows when this issue is going to come up again, and in light of the fact that this is harmless error anyway, I understand the court's not wanting to dive into something that could be harmless error. You can go right to that and dispose of the issue. But certainly in a case where you have a situation where the members need to be explained something that's not intuitive, like is allowed in other expert testimony. The fact that a mother or a father would actually kill their child on purpose is something that an expert can be helpful on in deciding. And this is the kind of, if you want to label this profile evidence, it should be another narrow exception as.
But that's slightly different than what was addressed in Traum, wasn't it? Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That may well be helpful, but that's not what was at issue in Traum. With respect to in Traum, the witness put a percentage possibility on the fact that a biological parent is the most likely person to kill a child. And you're transforming that now into a broader concept that discussion of parental abuse might be useful, or true.
I see I'm out of time, but may I?
Please answer the question.
I'm just trying to get you to be more precise.
To the extent that you feel able to do so, and then you're also welcome to make a brief concluding remark as well.
Well, you know, I stayed at the Holiday Inn Express last night. So, coming out, so I figured I'd be smarter up here, but... I guess the by comparing the two, I'm not sure I get the difference between what was said in Trom with regards to mostly it's the biological parents, as opposed to saying in this case that, and I think in Trom it was overwhelmingly it's the biological parents. And here, I don't know that she went quite that far, but certainly it's typically the biological parents. It's not unusual, not uncommon. So I think, though, that's the kind of evidence that should be allowed, and that's why we're asking. I think Trom in this case are similar, but that
I understand your position. You want to do it,
and you're welcome to make a concluding statement.
Thank you, Your Honor. In light of that, the government. Request this court of the issue one to find that the evidence, the witness's testimony from Mr. Jackson was not inconsistent, and the judge properly ruled in that case that the issue four was not profile evidence, and in any regard there was harmless error, and the same with the uncharged acts, that there was no prejudice, and the judge ruled properly in allowing that testimony to come in. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Counselor. We will now hear for the student amicus presenting argument on behalf of appellee.
Thank you, Judge Efron. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Bowersox with the Mississippi College School of Law, and we've submitted an amicus brief on issue four and whether or not Dr. Cooper's testimony crossed the line into impermissible profiling evidence of the accused. Your Honors, there has been some debate on whether this court drew the correct line between impermissible profiling evidence of the accused and permissible characteristic evidence of the infant victim in United States versus Trom. And the instant appeal provides this court with the opportunity to reaffirm Trom, and we respectfully submit that this court should affirm the lower court's ruling as a correct application of Trom. There are competing interests that must be weighed and balanced when considering this type
so
of expert.
So you would distinguish yourself from government counsel, true or false? And to what extent?
Well, Your Honor, first we would agree that if there is, the third statement by Dr. Cooper about the fact that most likely biological parents commit this type of offense on their children, if it is profiling, we wholeheartedly agree with the government that it is harmless error due to
right.
the facts of the case.
But do you agree with the government that it's not profiling and it should be generally admissible?
Yes, we do agree with that, Your Honor, because of the facts of the instant case makes the statement.
No, I meant in general as a principle of law. So you think it should have been admissible here and generally admissible?
Yes, Your Honor. But
and how I thought you were in favor, you thought the line drawn in Trom was a sound one.
Yes, Your Honor. And let me clarify the muddle I've just made of this. But we agree that the Trom, that statement was profiling evidence because it crossed the line from victim to the accused because of the facts of Trom and the fact that when Dr. Cooper testified that most likely it was the parents, only the accused was present in the house at the time of the injury to the baby in Trom.
Can I ask my question in a separate way then? In this case, was there profile evidence introduced that is harmless in your view, or is this an issue where the statement about the biological parent wasn't profile evidence?
We don't, in this case, Your Honor, we don't feel that the evidence was actually profiling evidence because of the fact that at the time of the injury to Destiny, you had both the mother and the father, both biological parents here. Due to the facts of the instant case, it changes.
Did the accused fit the profile of the testimony?
Yes, she did, but the father did as well. And this court stated in United States versus
Bank. So in theory, Bank, only two people could fit the profile. You would agree with that?
Well, yes, in this case.
So the judge should have ruled the evidence to be inadmissible because it was irrelevant in this case. That's a question, even though it's stated.
I realize that it was a question, Your Honor. I'm just not certain I know the answer to it.
I mean, putting it a different way, I mean, in this particular case, you have two individuals that the jury is looking at as the possible sources of the injury to the child, right?
Yes.
One is the mother, right? One is the biological father. We have the evidence that comes in that the most common person to fatally abuse a child is the biological parent, i.e. one of the two people that is sitting there. It seems to me that the argument has to either be Traum and Banks were wrongly decided and that this evidence should come in and is useful, or Traum should be limited to its facts, and here where there's two particular people that it applies to, that that it's not somehow pointing at one person because it could be either of them, or harmless error, or as the chief judge is suggesting, that in this particular case it wasn't necessary. It wasn't helpful to the trier of fact. They had two people there, both biological parents. No one was suggesting that it wasn't a shaken baby, right? I mean, they were arguing about which of the two parents did it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the best way to look at it, is the fact that in this particular case, it wasn't necessary for the panel. But as amicus, our argument is, in other cases, it can be very crucial, and that statement may be needed, may be necessary if a baby had been in multiple caretakers and there were more people than just the two parents. That statement by an expert may really go to educate the jury on the who and the how and the why of shaken baby and how it occurs, and that can be very important. So then
you do agree with the government that it should apply in all cases, or you agree, you stick with what you said in your brief, that it's only because the both parents were there this time?
Well, Your Honor, we support the government, but the amicus feels that Traum presents a workable standard, and that particular statement may be important in other cases depending on the facts of the case and depending on the military judge as the gatekeeper of admissibility of evidence.
Let's try to just to clarify then. I understand you're saying that in a case where you have one biological parent who is the accused and the other biological parent is not Jackson, somewhere else other than the bathroom, you would find that to be impermissible or permissible profile evidence?
It would be impermissible because
you like that line? Is that what you're urging us to adhere to as a concept of law?
Yes, Your Honor, because that does seem, if there's ever a case where a statement about a factor and a trait is going to cross the line into profiling evidence, it's when you have only one person who's the accused. And that goes directly to it, and that was this court's logic in Traum. And amicus is arguing that there is a balance between these rights of the accused and the rights of the victims, and one doesn't trump the other, they compete. And Traum presents the case based on the facts where that statement about the biological parents does profile the accused, but it does not profile the accused in Traum, and it may not in future cases. And government prosecution may actually need that type of testimony by an expert for a variety of different reasons, and this court should not state that this type of testimony can never come in, because then military judges will have a signal that they they can't even admit it from the get-go. They'll never consider what's behind the statement, the purpose, how it helps the panel members, because they'll have two rulings from this court that say you can't allow an expert to say that overwhelmingly or generally or in the majority of the times the biological parent is the one to commit this type of offense.
Where do you draw the line between enlightening the members and opining as an expert on the ultimate issue? Does Traum draw that line? Where do you draw that line?
Your Honor, Traum does draw that line and creates a line that a military judge as the gatekeeper can use. And there's a variety of tools that a military judge can use. But Traum shows that scenario where characteristic evidence of the infant victim crosses over and becomes profiling evidence of the accused. And it was just Dr. Cooper's third statement. It was not her other statements that crossed that line.
What about the statement with respect to the typical triggering event, which is a child crying, or the tying the trigger of a child abuse scenario to a child crying? How is that testimony that's only about the child and not about the perpetrator of the offense?
Because, Your Honor, it goes to whether or not what is the likely scenario that will cause shaken baby syndrome to occur. And one of those known is persistent crying by the infant. And it goes to the characteristics of the infant.
Well, wait a minute.
Or would be the impact on the listener.
Let's look at the question that was asked in that regard. The question was, so what's a trigger like that a baby does would cause a person that shakes them to do this? And so they're asking Dr. Cooper, what is the trigger that causes a reaction in an individual? Dr. Cooper says, that's been carefully researched. The most uniform baby trigger is crying. So that the question was asked and the answer was given as to the response of the individual that was there. So that doesn't talk about, while it mentions what the baby is doing, it is actually directed at the response from the individual who was present and was triggered by the baby's crying. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that the phrasing of that question does suggest that it crosses the line. But if the question had been asked just whether what is the triggering event for this type of infant abuse to occur, then amicus would suggest that that does not go to any type of characteristic of the accused and should be allowed to educate panel members who are probably not extremely knowledgeable on all of the different factors.
Panel members are not likely to be familiar with the concept that parents are the most likely source of child abuse and that crying babies is probably the most likely source of provocation to child abuse. That's something that that would come as a surprise to members of a court-martial panel.
Well, Judge, I think there is something counterintuitive. I see my time is up.
Absolutely. Please, please feel to either answer or ignore my question. You have complete discretion in that regard, and you may make a brief closing statement.
I would not choose to ignore you, Judge Efron. I was just going to say that there is something counterintuitive to most parents. There's the natural instinct to protect your own child, and it can be very difficult for a parent who is a panel member who is a parent to get past that. And this type of evidence, this what is a triggering event, goes to educate a panel under Military Rule of Evidence 702, which is why the military judge admitted it. In a brief conclusion, Your Honors, Traum represents the appropriate balance between the rights of the accused and the rights of the victim, and allowing characteristic evidence of the victim to be able to successfully prosecute these difficult and complex cases. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Appreciate the argument. Now, does the defense have rebuttal at this point?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Thank you. First, Your Honor, I just want to get back to the question that was asked earlier on about whether there was clear authority on whether the military judge has the authority to make a determination, whether the witness is intentionally being evasive. I think the best authority, and I don't have a specific part of the opinion, but I believe the most on-point decisions were United States versus Rogers and United States versus Saxon, because I know in those cases those witnesses were particularly uncooperative. But I do want to
proceed with the rest of your.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to speak to issue four as well. As we just discussed, this court analyzed very similar profile evidence in United States versus Trom and distinguished in that case between the characteristics of the victim and what parts of the testimony go to the characteristics of the appellant. And I just want to focus on the fact that also in United States versus Banks, it's important to remember that the factors in a profile are not limited to the characteristic trait of the appellant, but any information or data can also have the same effect, and I think that's what occurred in this case to some extent. And I would like to reference, I'm going to speak to the biological parent comment by the expert and some of the other factors of the profile that Dr. Cooper built for the government at trial. But I do want to mention Judge Erdman's concurring opinion in Trom, in which he wrote that testimony that in isolation would not constitute profiling evidence may well become profiling when heard in the context of a particular case. And just as Judge Erdman said Trom was such a case, this is also such a case. But the way Dr. Cooper was permitted to build this improper profile started with the question about the most common person to fatally abuse a child is a biological parent. That was the tip of the iceberg. But in that case, of course, it was found to be harmless error because the appellant, Stephanie Trom, had actually, her confession came into evidence as well. And additionally, in Trom, the critical question was the cause of death rather than who did it. And you have exactly the opposite situation here. The question is who did it, and the cause of death is largely not in question. And
what's your best prejudice argument with the fact that the two players here are both biological parents?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the prejudice comes from, with respect to that particular question, comes from the factual situation of these parents and the way the question was asked. Tony Jackson was more of a visitor in that household when this baby was injured. Airman Harrow was the primary caregiver.
But it was clear that he was a biological parent, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you agree that there was no evidence presented at trial suggesting that the perpetrator was someone other than the appellant in this case, Will Jackson?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry. Finish answering Judge Baker's question.
What was that again, Your Honor?
No, you
sorry.
You had a chance.
Okay.
Well, are you essentially asking us to, the way you see the evidence, it's substitute for biological parent, parental caregiver?
I think that question was improper based on the court's opinion in Trom, but I think also it has to be read in context, the facts of this case. So in a sense, my answer is yes.
Okay, thank you.
And then additionally, we had some discussion about the most uniform baby trigger here. The defense does agree that question and answer reaches both to the characteristics of the victim as well as the typical offender. And just my final point on this, because I'm almost out of time, but there was also some testimony from this expert witness that essentially reverse profiled Tony Jackson, essentially the testimony that excluded him. and I am out of time, so.
You may briefly conclude, and we have your brief, so you need not address all six issues in your conclusion.
Thank you, Your Honor. In closing, Chief Judge Efron and honorable judges of this court, military judge erred in disallowing the inconsistent statements of Mr. Jackson based on an erroneous view of the law. Additionally, he allowed the prosecution to present improper profile evidence through Dr. Cooper. And finally, the military judge allowed improper character evidence under MRE 404B. We respectfully ask this court to set aside the findings of guilt as to the murder charge and its specification, as our client, Airman Harrow, was unable to get a fair trial as a result of this military judge's errors. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your able presentations today. We particularly thank counsel for the amicus for both parties for your able presentations. We're well aware of the challenge and pressures of law school and the limited time available, and we're grateful for you devoting that time to the court today. With that, the case is submitted, and the clerk will adjourn the court. After he does so, the judges will remain in place for an informal question and answer session.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.
Well, thank you. We are, again, delighted to be here. This was a